Well, from the last lecture, I think you would have seen that you can get a lot of things right in life. You can get a lot of things wrong. Even your marriage, your relationships, finances, individual passages of the Bible. But one thing you can't get wrong is the gospel. I hope you've seen that from the last lecture. So my encouragement to you is that you encourage all church members and friends who want to be focused on God and what He's done for us to at least come for the FWC conference every year. We'll go through, we are going through a program that I think will help the church to really refocus on the importance of the gospel. So the following year after that, we'll do gospel and truth, which relates to doctrine. And then after that, we'll talk about how the church needs to live in this world. And we'll try to get some... hopefully we can afford it, but we're trying to get some people in who can talk about gospel and culture and all that. Lecture 6, difficulties in interpretation. Now, my goal in this lecture was to cover some formal difficulties which will trickle their way down into your ministry when you start especially interacting with the scholarship on Deuteronomy. And also to deal with some, I think, common difficulties in reading the content of Deuteronomy in your own time. I'm sure as you were preparing for what works, when you came to some difficult passages, you thought, this is really strange, and this is just, this is actually in the Bible. Now, for the second part, though, which is not the formal difficulties or difficulties to do scholarly work, the more I think about it, I see less and less a need for me to actually spend too much time on it because of the coverage of the lectures. As I was going through the content of lectures, I saw that the more we understand how to read the Bible well, the less we need to have just specific answers for everything. It all has to do with how you read it in context. So, but let me start now with the issues from historical critical interpretation. One issue that keeps coming up, of course, is continuities and discontinuities. Now, we sense this in both the content and style and the themes of the book when you're reading it. You sense the tension between the relationship between this book and the rest of the books, or even within itself. And modern interpretation has seen the place of Deuteronomy in the canon as complex because of Deuteronomy's relationship not only to the books before it, but the books that come after it, Joshua and Kings. Just give me a minute while I get Joy to grab me a book. So the books that come after Joshua to Kings are sometimes seen as being part of Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy belongs to that set rather than the Pentateuch. So whenever scholars look at Deuteronomy, sometimes you see it as the odd man out because, that's an Australianism, right? Odd man out, sore thumb, something like that. Okay. As the odd man out, because they see it either as the introduction to other books or the conclusion to other books. And they often do see that it is an unfinished conclusion. They see it as just hanging there and not really fitting by itself. Now, if you're sitting here wondering, how does this actually affect my reading of Deuteronomy? Well, it does. Once scholars start asking questions like, are you sure that's what it means? Because, you know, isn't it better to read Deuteronomy in light of Joshua, let's say? If they see, especially since for them, as you know, as I'm trying to teach you, they don't actually see chapters and verses as clear divisions, as you should in yourself. So if it's all just in one sense a jumble of words, if I can put it that way, then the next words and the next words and the next words and the words before and the words before and the words before and the words before all affect what you think about these words. So they have a very big view in one sense of the Bible, whereas you perhaps a very small, narrow view. Because for you, you've been infected by the whole Zondervan, NIV, ESV, publication, published Bible culture, where for you, the book starts when an editor tells you that's where it starts. So if you have a big bold lettering that says Deuteronomy, and then you get notes in your study notes, and then when it ends, for instance. Have you ever experienced that in Mark 16, for instance? Mark 16, the ending is actually verse 9. But since we get published Bibles which go all the way to verse 16, for you always think it ends in verse 16. Well, it doesn't. especially if you have an original autograph, or, well, you have an original copy, a copy of the original languages, like the United Bible Society's Greek, or the Hebrew Bible, the Masoretic text. When you read that as a scholar, you can see that the text is much bigger, and so the complexities of the text are much greater. So when you're sitting there thinking, this is not quite relevant to me, I hope you change your mind on this, because when the commentators comment on a text, or your pastor thinks about text in the original languages, it will flow through to things like meaningful units and lesson plans, etc. Anyway, when you read the commentaries, you'll struggle because they're assuming many of these things. So when you read a book in the Old Testament, the relationship between that book and the books that come after or before it definitely goes some way in affecting how you see it. And so, for instance, as I mentioned in one of the lectures in lecture two on structure, Von Rad, how does he see it? Well, he sees the whole thing, Deuteronomy, as a hexateuch. So it concludes in Joshua. So interpretation of Deuteronomy will definitely be affected by what is said in Joshua. On the other hand, you have Martin Nord, whom I talked to you about, and he sees that the Pentateuch is actually a tetrateuch, so it's not a Pentateuch, it's four books. And so Deuteronomy is clearly, for him, very different in style and content from the first four books, and what's stronger is the link between that and what's after. And that also, therefore, is that would mean a negative view of the word or the name Deuteronomy, second law, that would see that Deuteronomy is a reworking of Exodus. They would see it negatively. I won't comment on that much. I've got a point on that in the difficult content. But that's one of the implications. Whereas you, if you think of it as a Pentateuch and you're a Christian trying to be, you're trying to be reading the Bible faithfully, you'd have questions about how the Ten Commandments are different in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, but you'd still try to work out how they still represent one mind, Moses' mind. Whereas the scholars might think, or would think, it's two different people, actually. Can you see? It now affects authorship, which is going to be our next point soon. So these are ongoing issues in the interpretation of Deuteronomy and the Pentateuch as a whole. And in handling the difficulties outlined in this lecture, it's very important for you to remember that there is value in listening to these critical views. The main problem I had in theological college, my first 2 years especially, or 1 year and a half, was my firewall was too darn strong. You know how firewalls get very irritating after a while? Every email goes to junk mail, and then anything people say to you, or even important mails, just get thrown away. Well, it's the same thing. It's very hard to learn if you're not open to criticism, if you're not open to hard questions. So when you do Bible studies, for instance, when people ask you really tough questions, partly because they're irritating, maybe you've got a Christian who's very arrogant who thinks he knows a lot. He's got his big ESV study Bible, and he says, Paul Barker says, what is, you know, and or on the other hand, because he's maybe a non-Christian, is very inquisitive. Don't treat these questions as bad things. When I was in marketing, they always taught us that customer complaints is positive, helps you to improve. I always laugh at businesses in KL, of which there are many, who don't receive complaints. Because when you complain to them, aircon too hot, they don't care. Well, I'm not coming back. Of course, in KL, that theory doesn't work because people always come back, even though service is bad. So our fault, lah. But you see, criticisms like this hopefully will help you to think clearer. And so that's why in Workbooks, we actually have one of these lectures. I'll try more harder as a producer to tell the speakers to include one of these lectures, because previous to this in Workbooks, we've always assumed that, let's not deal with these theories, but it's important that we actually think about it. So don't be afraid to interact with them, in other words. Embrace the pain. That's a theme to this Workbook. Embrace the questions. Struggle with them. Think through them. Irritate your pastor. Ask, why does Martin not think that? And do you think that's actually helpful? But with regards to the issue, and you're waiting for the solution, I guess. I always was. I used to have lecturers who would go on for 45 minutes. Very godly, very conservative, really love the Bible lecturers. Who tells all the problems of the particular book and how it possibly couldn't have been written by Paul, and then the bell rings. And all of you like, we're all white-faced at the end of the thing, like, you mean Philippians wasn't written by Paul? I think Philippians wasn't written by Paul. He just said, didn't he? We're talking about people like Peter O'Brien, okay? Peter O'Brien, top Philippians scholar in the world. Beautiful man. But often he wouldn't have enough time. So now you're waiting for my answer, right? Well, the answer's already, I've already given it to you. That's why I'm not so worried. Deuteronomy, I hope, yes, you've experienced the last 2 days. You've seen it's got a clear literary unity, both in style and content within itself. And again, your good old friend, the ANE Treaty, Ancient Near East Treaty, helps you again, because the ANE Treaty form is pretty much self-contained. So the matching of those two forms help you to see that, in part, what seems to be a problem of that the historical scholars give us, that is that Deuteronomy is floating, it doesn't fit left and right. Well, that's true, because in that sense, it is a coherent, self-contained piece of literature. And as we've seen also in terms of the narrative of the Pentateuch, moving on to the prophets, as I've pointed out in, I think it was lecture one, Deuteronomy is a pause. Deuteronomy is a pause in the historical narrative. It is exposition. So in terms of style, of course, it's going to be slightly different. It's sermonic. So if you look at the Exodus materials all the way to Numbers, you're going to say things like, oh, look, it's all priestly material. It's about worship and sacrifice and liturgy. How come Deuteronomy is so different? Maybe another guy wrote it. Have you ever considered, well, I'm sure they do consider it, but have you ever considered that one guy can write in many different styles, just like Robin can have two different hairstyles over 2 days? It's possible, you know. It is possible. Sometimes scholars get too precise about these things, and we truly appreciate their work, because it takes a great deal of brains and PhDs to notice that one author talks a certain way, Paul writes a certain way, Peter writes a certain way, but sometimes I think you can go overboard at those conclusions. So it will differ somewhat from previous material as well as from consequent material. And you can say that without having to say Moses didn't write Deuteronomy. So let me quote to you from McConville. It's best to think of Deuteronomy as having both a concluding function and an orientation towards the ensuing history, given its nature as an exhortation to the people to keep the covenant once they have the land. So again, you see here, your best friend is to be familiar with content. That's still your best friend, even if you don't know any scholarship or any issues. But of course, all that I've said flows into the question of authorship. And by the way, can I just check on this? I really want to know, in your churches, and you don't have to say myself, but in your churches, have you ever heard of anyone saying Deuteronomy was not written by Moses? Anyone? Do your churches talk about Deuteronomy? You've heard of someone say that? This was in Berkeley again? Wow. And who was it? Sorry. Can I just ask what church it is? Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, you mean someone who attends seminary? What's GK? GK, what's the STM position on the Pentateuch? Do you know? We're amongst friends. You don't have to say this is the official position of STM, but amongst friends, let's just hear what the STM thinks. Okay. I'm jumping at one point now, but do they believe in the documentary hypothesis? Do you know about that? JEDP? Look, JEDP, some good points to it, but anybody's, you know, JEDP is the truth. Okay, interesting. Well, I don't believe that Moses wrote Deuteronomy 34. That's my position. I don't think, it's not like during leadership interviews in my church, I'll ask you, did Moses write 34, 1 to 12? You don't believe it? You can't be a leader. Moses wrote every verse! Well, I don't think Moses wrote that verse, and I don't think you should condemn me or I should condemn you either for either, but there's a limit to these things. I think to an extent, after a while, if you say Moses didn't say these things, then you start having other ministry problems. And we'll work through it now, but as you can see, it's not as foreign an idea. It's interesting that someone who was practicing, field education from STM, someone from STM actually had that view. So you can't think these are just Western ideas. They're being taught in local seminaries. Any self-respecting seminary, let's put it that way, any self-respecting Bible college, theological colleges especially, who want to reach a certain standard of academic quality, they have to examine you on these things. They have to. It's the current scholarship. So you might go into Bible culture young, inexperienced, beautiful, naive sheep, lamb, pastor. And then by the time you come out, you go like, God didn't write all the books of the Bible. One of my senior pastors reminded us of this when he said, when he was in England for a short sabbatical, in a local church which was supposed to be evangelical, and I don't think necessarily you are unevangelical for saying this, but in this church, the pastor stood up and said, 1 Peter, and he started reading and said, we don't know who wrote Peter. And my pastor was furious. He was like, you just read 1 Peter. What do you mean you don't know who wrote 1 Peter? And it gets to a point where it gets quite dangerous because 2 Peters, you know, supposedly written by someone who was pretending to be Peter, etc. And before Deuteronomy now, let me move on to authorship and dating, and I'll show you how we need to think about this. Mosaic authorship began to be systematically questioned in the modern period, last two centuries, and it came about because a scholar called De Reed, 1805, observed that the book differed in style and content from the preceding books. We've just noted that. He further observed in passing that the reform of King Josiah, which is, of course, you know, is 2 Kings 22 to 23, may have been the occasion of its authorship because, as he said in 22 verse 8, the book of the law was found during repairs in the temple. Now, David was only making a passing observation, but my, an industry exploded from that observation. Because this, of course, affects the dating of the book. And from this initial observation, we now have in scholarship four main views that have been proposed about the authorship. Okay, four main views. By the way, this is what happens when Christians sit in an ivory tower called Bible College and study. They come up with theories, you see. That's good, that's bad. But A, the first option, of course, is a substantially Mosaic date with a certain amount of post-Mosaic material. That's the position I take. B, a date in the period of Samuel to Solomon. So Deuteronomy was written in Solomon's time. You got that in your brain, okay? Much of the material is held to go back to the time of Moses, but the compilation of it is actually 300 to 400 years after Moses' death. So you get bits and pieces, maybe some guy with his PDA was recording Moses' thing, another person took some camera photo shots, and then you put it all together 300 years later in Solomon's time. C, the third option is that it's a date in the Hezekiah-Josiah period, which is the 7th century BC. Okay, everybody understand BC, right? Big numbers or small numbers. Don't get confused on that. It's not denied that there may be a considerable amount of Mosaic material and that Mosaic principles underlie much of the work. So no one's actually saying a guy called John Chan wrote all this. People are saying, oh no, Moses said a lot of it or whatever, but it flowed into its current form. It was gathered together much, much later, 7th century Josiah's time. And by far, I think this is probably the most popular thought. And it was gathered because the religious and prophetic circles of that time were concerned to have a manifesto or a document that they could use to call Israel back to the good old days. That's how I'll put it for you. Right? So the way they thought it would work best to call people back to the good old glory days of Moses was, well, tell everyone the famous speeches from Moses' time. Let's put it together. Let's find what we can use to set this up, a bit like a propaganda movie, I guess. And that's how they understand Deuteronomy. The fourth option is a post-exilic date, so that's even later, obviously. And the book isn't a program of reform under this thinking, but it's the wishful thinking of unrealistic post-exilic dreamers. You can see how the theory gets worse. So it's like, oh, you know, we've come back from the exile. Things are horrible. The good old days. So they wrote this whole thing as like a wish list of how it should be, it could be, but never was. So the crucial issue for us here, therefore, is that when such a view of authorship is taken, the consequent result, as you can see from the four different dates from A to E, D, the consequent result is that the book is not a faithful record of Moses' teaching. Although you have to say that, all right, a guy called Moses did this bit, or a guy called Moses contributed to this bit, eventually you've got to say, well, it's not really Moses' thinking, because whatever Moses said anyway, if he said A, B, C, D, E, F, but the editor put it together as B, G, Z, C from some other guy, and then put it together as D, well, whose work is it now? You understand? If you think about movies, it's something like that. You've got to ask the question of scriptwriter, to producer, to script, producer script writer, to director, to cutting floor room editor. Now, in the movies, the editor always tries to follow the director's vision. But here, we have in huge doubt, because of all these different datings and sources, you're in huge doubt in one sense. The Christians left with some concern as to who really wrote whatever. To some extent, decisions about dating depend on whether the biblical writers can be thought to have foreseen conditions and events in Israel's history. So you got to admit that there were a lot of non-Christians doing Christian scholarship. And that's the way it is in the West, in Asia as well, actually. Because all you have to do to get a PhD scholarship or whatever opportunity to do a PhD is you have to be brilliant. That's all. Godly people don't come out of Bible college. That's one of the things I keep saying what works. Smart people come out of Bible college. Or some people who feel really bad about how bad they did. But smart people who go into Bible college, who get PhDs, can come out any theories they want as long as they prove to their supervisor it makes sense. And especially if he wants it to make sense, it will make sense. So one of the key things that in the Enlightenment period, in the modern period of Western philosophy, that influenced the way they think about this is that prophecy can't possibly be true. It's not logical. So if you have prophecies that or anticipations of exile in Babylon that you've seen in the last lecture, well, it can't have been written before the exile. Because that would mean that they're predicting something. Well, you can't have that in the Bible. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? So it's got to be written around the exile's time or after. And that's got to be the only way you can date it, goes the reasoning, because it's foreshadowing events that haven't happened. Who writes like that? That's just weird. So in one sense, once I've shown you my, I've said to you that I don't think Moses wrote Deuteronomy 34, to some extent that opens me up to this argument, opens me up to buying into this argument, doesn't it? Because I'm saying Moses couldn't have written it because it predicts his death. Do you understand what I'm saying? But then the same logic is what people apply to saying things like, well, the exile is predicted in chapter 30, couldn't have been written because Moses is talking about something that hasn't happened. Or in Isaiah, Cyrus will come and save us. Well, you don't know that because it hasn't happened yet. It must be after the event. So I am completely between the two camps. Those guys who say Moses didn't write 1 to 34 because of chapter 34. And the guys who are like, rah, rah, we're all for the Bible, we're conservative, 1 to 34 is written by Moses, how dare you, or, you know, I'll punch you if you say Moses didn't write chapter 34. Between those two, who do you think I'll choose as my best friend or my cousin? It's going to be the conservative guys, because the other guys can be dangerous. At least this guy actually believes in the Bible. Okay? I don't take that position because of the training I've received, and I want to approach the Bible with a certain amount of logic and reasoning as well. But I prefer those guys any day to over the house than the other ones. You understand what I'm trying to say? Okay? That's kind of the tone of what works as well. Okay? We're not outrageously conservative to the point where we don't use reasoning. But reasoning can be a problem. Also, it gets to very ludicrous levels, I think. The reasoning can be very, like, the scholarship's reasoning can be very practical. They say things like, well, if the laws in Deuteronomy presuppose presuppose a settled existence in the land, an agricultural lifestyle, when they're actually nomads at this point, well, it can't have been written during Moses' time. So it talks about laws that are in place for agricultural life that obviously will have to take place once they go into the land. And the scholar says, well, clearly it was written after they went in, so it wasn't written by Moses. Well, that's just jumping the gun. So there are independent reasons, however, for thinking that Deuteronomy was actually written much closer. So I think as a conservative evangelical, you don't necessarily want to say, when you're arguing or debating these things, you don't necessarily have to say it was written by Moses, by his pen in his time. You can just move the debate further back. And the way you do it is to point out these things. First, Deuteronomy actually shows no knowledge of the main institutions of Israel's political and religious life during the period of the kings. So two can play the same game in that sense. Okay? Namely, the kings themselves and the Jerusalem temple. So these institutions are not in there in Deuteronomy, especially when you look at verses like 12, verse 5, which talks about the place in the generic. The place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there. It's often taken by these scholars that That is a disguised allusion to Jerusalem. All right. Why do you think if it was written during Josiah's period, it'd be a disguised allusion based on the scholar's reasoning? Well, because in the reasoning, if you're a priest during Josiah's time trying to call for back to the glory of the good old days, you're not going to make it obvious that you're writing it during your time. So you're going to fake it a bit or touch it up a bit so that you'll make it ambiguous enough so that it'll sound like a really ancient document. So you're going to write it from perspective of pre-Josiah, obviously, and obviously pretending to be Moses' time. So really, as you can see here, the way theories work is you form a picture in your mind of what you want to say or what you want it to mean, and you just use whatever you have to prove it. And it works. That's the problem with theories, you see. You're still, after a while, you're starting to just work with just concepts, ideas, instead of the text. So that's the first reason why we should be more cautious about those theories. Deuteronomy actually shows no knowledge of the main institutions of Israel's political and religious life during the period of the kings. The second reason is that Deuteronomy in chapter 17, so chapter 17 is actually very important for you. Deuteronomy in chapter 17, I think this is one of the most convincing arguments. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 to 20, is unenthusiastic about a king. So it doesn't reflect the period of the monarchy because Deuteronomy has a very different vision of the king. It's almost, in Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20, depending how you read it, it's almost not anti-monarchy, but pro-people. It has a very different vision of the king. It's not the typical chief executive of the state kind of king. And so it couldn't possibly, I think, have come from a time of Josiah, because just in Josiah's time, Josiah was Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, let's say, Mr. Chief Executive, getting everything moving in the right direction. Well, that's not how it works in Deuteronomy 17. Secondly, Deuteronomy only knows a single united Israel. It doesn't show any acquaintance with division of the nation into two kingdoms. Thirdly, the book warns again and again about the dangers of Canaanite religion. And Deuteronomy's concern, therefore, is an understandable concern of an early period of Israel's nation's history. I mean, of course, there's still a factor of Canaanite religion, but the entire book is talking more about how you've got to go in and get rid of these temples and sacrifices of the Canaanites. Fourthly, certain laws make best sense in relation to the occupation of land. So one word like this is chapter 12, verse 15 to 25, which actually permits the kind of like secular eating of meat. The law is actually in contrast to Leviticus 17. So when you look at Leviticus 17 versus Deuteronomy 12 verse 5, you see that this contrast is best explained by the fact that after settling in the land, the distance to the central sanctuary is going to be too great for some people, because you can see in the geography, north, south. So that setting itself is made best sense of by a Mosaic period. Fifthly, Deuteronomy shares the concerns of the prophets, namely the need for heartfelt religion, love of justice, rights of the poor. But it is different. So it shares the concerns, but it's different from the prophetic book. So at least in that point, it places it within the prophetic canon. But it doesn't address particular concerns and individuals, which the prophets do. It has much more of an appearance of a program for the future. So as you can see, all these arguments have to do with the content. So again and again, you've got to keep looking at content, despite the fact that when the critical scholars look at it, they use it to prove their theory. I don't think you should then create another theory to fight their theory. You'll see this especially in the next point I'll make about how the documentary hypothesis came from a theory from a conservative. But anyway, the point I'm making here is don't fight fire with fire, fight it with the Bible. That's what I'm trying to say, regardless of what they say after all. So finally, it has been shown, and I think this is the argument. And it's dangerous because it's depending on an external authority in one sense, slightly. But finally, Deuteronomy resembles political treaties made by Hittite kings and famous law codes like Hammurabi, which puts it in Moses' time, and not in the first century, which has its own forms of treaties and laws. So when scholars compare the two, they go, well, that's a very weird form if it's going to be first century, if it's going to be later. It just looks much better when it fits there. And I think yeah, although there can be arguments against that, I think that's actually reasonably conclusive, and I think scholars are starting to accept that more. But in any case, data cannot prove conclusively any of the dates canvassed for Deuteronomy, but I think you should think about it as being pretty close to Moses, if not at Moses' time. I think it's written by Moses, but that's my scholarly answer. Okay, the composition of Deuteronomy, now we get to the so-called good stuff, the documentary hypothesis. One theory that affects all reading of the Pentateuch is the documentary hypothesis. A very important word in that phrase is hypothesis. Okay, it's like evolution. When Christians fight about it a lot, try to remember it's a theory. Don't bet your life on it. Bible's not a theory, but the evolutionary theory and documentary hypothesis are hypothesis. So this is the standard explanation of the development of the Pentateuch. Do you understand this? Scholars, when they read the Pentateuch, evangelical scholars, conservative scholars, have no choice but to interact with this. Your supervisor will laugh at you if you don't at least acknowledge or work with it. Now, so this hypothesis reaches definitive formulation in the late 19th century. So it started around the 1800s and then it got up to its peak at the end. And it dominated discussion for about a century. So in one sense, we've only just started recovering from it. So for about 200 years, this is it. This is how Christians have had to think about it. In fact, Christian denominations, major Christian denominations, okay? So not cults or anything like that, like just Presbyterians or Anglicans, they all accepted this theory. The church, okay? Church leadership, your bishop, everybody, they accepted this theory. The documentary hypothesis is a child of the Enlightenment, and during this period, during the Enlightenment period, which is about the 1800s on, various people began to question Mosaic authorship by pointing out some apparent inconsistencies, like the description of Moses' death and repeated stories. So this point itself is helpful for you to think about in ministry, you see. If you want to be blinkered and you want to avoid what the scholars say, eventually a smart young man or smart young girl from youth group will ask you about these things, like, how come Abraham seems to have given up his wife twice? Or how come Jesus seems to be going into Jerusalem once in this gospel, but going out of Jerusalem on the same donkey in this other gospel? So if people read their Bibles well, and you don't want to think about these things, well, keep living in a dream, man. People will ask you these questions. Now, during this period, as I said, because of a reason-based thinking about the Bible, people started asking questions about whether Moses could possibly have written something like this, given the inconsistencies. And the base elements of the theory come from a guy called Jean Astruc, who's a French guy. And he was trying to help the situation. So people were asking questions about how it was possible that Moses wrote this. And in his attempt to help, what he did was to come up with a theory to explain all the inconsistencies. And he explained that there were different authors, different people who compiled the different bits that Moses wrote originally. So his theory was, okay, look at this A story and this B story that's similar to this A story. But what happens is Moses wrote three or four versions of the same story in parallel columns. And then in over time, editors took it, or authors of the book took it, and combine it all together to make one story. Now, remember, Jean Astruc was trying to help. He was trying to make it better. He was trying to say, I've got an answer for why you think that there's all these inconsistencies. Here's the answer. But then what he did became, therefore, the pathway for the documentary hypothesis. And the documentary hypothesis is built on three pillars. Okay? Three pillars. Firstly, the Pentateuch has four main sources. And that's your first diagram in your outlines. The first diagram. The Pentateuch has four main sources. J, E, D, P. Okay? I leave you to read the details of that diagram. Secondly, Deuteronomy is dated to the 7th century. So you can see now how the dating issues that we talked about before are affecting this. One of the key pillars of the documentary hypothesis is built on the assumption, a supposedly proven assumption, that Deuteronomy was definitely not written by Moses. It was definitely written during Josiah's time. So one theory leads to another. So another pillar of the documentary hypothesis is Deuteronomy was written in the 7th century in Josiah's time. Thirdly, the dating of the priestly material, which is from Exodus 25 to Numbers 30, so that's a huge amount of material, Exodus 25 to Numbers 30, that was not written in the time of Exodus or Numbers, that was written in the time of the 5th century BC. Okay? During a time when Israel went through sacrificial life together, life where there was the temple and liturgy. Now, let me read for you one of the paragraphs from this book. I think that should help you a little bit. As you look at these diagrams, just listen. In practice, the documentary hypothesis dissects books into sources, as you can see from diagrams, which in the present Pentateuch, as you can in your Bibles, are closely interwoven. In the English-speaking world, the great advocate of the documentary hypothesis was as our driver was a professor of Hebrew at Oxford. And under your third diagram, or on your third diagram, I think it's your third diagram, documentary hypothesis, source, name of God, character, content, that's a diagram, a simplified diagram of his thesis. All that stuff you see on the left, the source, is J-E-P. And so what he did was divide up the whole of Genesis into these different sources. He basically went through the whole thing and tagged each one to a supposedly different author or different source. So, Driver's basically saying that based on the language within Genesis or within the Pentateuch, you can work out where it comes from. And therefore, you can work out a theory of the development of the Pentateuch as a whole, together with the approximate date. So when you look at your next diagram with the arrows, J-E, J-E-D, J-E-D-P, that's basically how Driver understood the Pentateuch to have come together. So you start with J, which is a more simple state, a reflection of more simple faith in Israel. And then J and E come together, and J and E are quite similar in a sense. J, E, and then D. D is a bit more legalistic, comes to a point in Israel's life setting where they have institutionalized things a bit more. And then P is more ritualistic. It's the priestly era. So J, E, D, P together give you, well, the compilation of the Pentateuch. And based on this theory, you get a dating of the sources, which is your next diagram. Right? You can see that under this theory, J was written in 950, proceeding to the final form in 450. That's how you get, in the end, a 450 date for the Pentateuch, the final form. So by the early 20th century, which is just around the corner from where we are now, behind us, this hypothesis was widely accepted. It was widely accepted in secular universities. So if you're a secular person doing a secular degree in, like Tripos in Oxford, or a secular PhD on the Bible, this would be what you believe. This is what your supervisor will mark you on. Protestant denominations all accepted it. Okay? So it'd be interesting to see if there's anyone still alive from the early 19th century, any pastors from that those denominations, what they would think about this if you interviewed them. And it'd be interesting to see in Malaysia whether this flowed through to us as well, pre-Merdeka. And in the mid-20th century, in fact, the Roman Catholic Church, which is traditionally very conservative, fully admitted this theory. Now, the only people throughout those 200 years, and this is the interesting bit in this whole story in one sense, the only people who rejected it outright, said, no, that's complete nonsense, can you guess? Orthodox Jews. You wonder where the Christians are. This is supposed to be our book, after all. The Orthodox Jews, conservative Christians, right? Conservative Christians, they said very clearly, this undermines the authority and inspiration of the Bible. I'll leave it to you to work out whether or not that's true. Now, in the last decades of the 20th century, however, and so I'm teaching you now at this point in the history of the church and not earlier, because this is the moral of the story. In the last decades of the 20th century, however, the situation in scholarship is very confused, very confused. Many scholars, secular, Christian, conservative, non-Christian, liberal, many scholars have rejected parts of the theory or the whole theory. So you see, if you're someone who in the 19th century or mid 20th century held on to this for dear life and fought with your bishop, he would have agreed with you, and fought with your congregation about this, well, that'd be a very sad story, because you held on to a theory instead of a Bible for dear life, a theory of the Bible for dear life as opposed to the Bible. And in the end, even the guys you've been loyal to, your supervisors and all that, they've changed their mind now. So both sources and dating are highly questioned today. Now, it's not as if we go to secular universities now, JEDP is no longer there. It's still there. You still have to talk about it, but it's confused. Nobody has any full agreement anymore. And so I want to recommend to you exploring the Old Testament series. I haven't really seen anything like this level of explanation. Clear, simple, nice diagrams, helpful for the layperson in any book. Every other commentary will assume that you understand these things. And I can tell you, after the second, third year of Bible college, I didn't even get as clear an explanation as this that I've just given you. Because, you know, I don't know, my lecturers didn't teach at this level. So I found the exploring series to be really helpful for your level, because it's just right for you. It's not the highly academic level, it's practical, but it does explain it well. Now, let me share with you then you're all waiting for the solution in one sense. But let me share with you from Kleins. David Kleins, he's not necessarily conservative, but there's been a move away from this kind of scholarship to, shall we say, a more sensible scholarship, which deals actually with the text. So David Kleins, an Australian by birth, he's taught for 30 years at Sheffield University. And one of his most influential works is The Theme of the Pentateuch. And what that was it was a breath of fresh air, and it brought a fresh approach to the Old Testament study, which now, if you read McConville is someone who writes in this way precisely because Kleins opened the way for him. And that's what happens in scholarship, right? One brave guy, in this case, he's not necessarily conservative, he's just suggesting a different way of doing things. Someone opens up a new way, everybody just kind of gets in line. And then supervisors will push the thesis in a particular direction or help you to see that that's what you need to interact with. And so there'll be a certain trend in scholarship for a while. And so Kleins points out that for two centuries, biblical scholars have been preoccupied with historical questions such as, did Joshua capture Jericho? Do you remember this one? When I was a Christian in the 80s, this was like the big thing. And even at a layperson's level, this was like such a big issue for me. What was biblical leprosy? What exactly was it? How can you call it leprosy if the symptoms don't quite match the 21st century form? Or how was the book of Genesis written, as you saw from Astro? But indeed, it was often asserted that the key to understanding texts was to understand the circumstances of their composition. So you can see how in Word Works, if this point is true from the 19th century, that the key to understanding a text is not the text so much, but how the text got to its final shape, then what I've done for you in Word Works, if I had run this in the 19th century, 100 years ago, in some hotel here or in England, all of you would have laughed at me. Because you'd be going, how can you put the composition of the text as a sixth lecture? My God, that's so stupid. Obviously, if you started that, if you don't even know like who wrote what and where it comes from, how can you even talk about meaning? You see what I'm saying? But you see, Word Works today, 21st century, by a conservative evangelical pastor, we're doing it as a sixth lecture. And hopefully now you're all feeling okay because you've got the content in your mind, so you know how to deal with these theories. The important questions were, who wrote them? When? Why? So the works of North and von Rad are excellent examples of this approach. They try to establish the message of the Pentateuch by describing the process of its composition from short oral stories. Okay, so it was told orally, what did Moses say, my son? Okay, you tell a couple of stories. Together into a form of creeds, where a congregation would get up and repeat it again and again, to the present lengthy books of Genesis to Deuteronomy. But David Kleins and many other modern scholars have argued that this is the wrong approach to literature, to reading. Do you understand? It's a wrong approach to reading. That's the point that I'm making. And that's why this has gained favor, because it's not coming from a conservative Christian, oh, the Bible's written by the Holy Spirit answer. If you write that in a thesis, no one's going to listen to you in that sense. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying It doesn't work with the world's way of reasoning. But if you say, well, actually, no. What's the question here? Are we trying to understand history? Is this the history department of Oxford? Or is this the literature department of Oxford? The answer is, we're about reading the Bible. Fine. So as a non-Christian, I can say the best way to read this Bible is deal with the text. Okay? That's why Christians get excited. Like my lecturers, they get excited about literary criticism because it provides a way out for them. They can have their PhDs, they can be academic, and yet Christian. It's saying, let's work out what the text is saying. Now, over the years, I'll tell you more about what I think about that, but in any case, this provided a way out for us. So the original historical criticism was wrong because it was a wrong approach to literature. It was wrong because it concentrated on the detail at the expense of the whole picture, so like single verses, single names, single place names. Minor issues are discussed at length, whereas the overall message is ignored. Remember the illustration of the piece of iron on a nail? Second, this approach is misguided because it is so speculative. It's amazing, isn't it, how taxpayers funded I don't know how many hundreds of PhDs, causing thousands of pounds and US dollars each, to say things which were just completely just made up. But that's what happens, I think, sometimes with PhDs. We really do not know how biblical books came to be written. It's so common sense in one sense. You think, why did God have to send us David Klein to say such common sense things? But that's how it works. David Klein said, hey, look, guys, you're just talking about stuff that you don't know. You can't know. Especially in the early stages, you can't know because, well, how can we possibly know how it was written in this early stage? So to base our interpretation of the text on how the book came about, on guesses, well, that's a very dubious procedure. Can you see? You're interpreting the text as you have it based on some theory of how it came about, that text. So what you're doing now is you're studying history, but you said you were studying interpretation of the text. You've confused the two categories. So interpretation should begin with the final form of the text. That's a key thing you need to remember. You don't have the long and complicated version 1 to version 57 Microsoft Word of how Moses wrote it. You don't even have the scraps of paper that Moses wrote as he was thinking about something while he was walking around in the desert. Do you understand what I'm saying? Would you know what to do with it anyway if you had Moses's version 1 to 57 in his notepad from his desert experience? Would you know what to do if it was some bits that look at Deuteronomy 26? You don't, because it's not part of Deuteronomy 26 yet. It's just a couple of thoughts he put down on his notepad. The only way you can make sense out of that, the context that was in his whole brain, is in the final form. When he gives you chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, so that 26 makes sense because it's the 26th chapter of 34 chapters. In his pocket, when it comes out of his mouth, when he's just rambling and thinking, just single verses. Do you understand what I'm trying to say now? Okay? So no need to be frightened, okay, of this theory. It may be possible, having established the meaning of the final text, to make suggestions about earlier forms of the text and what they may have meant. But these inferences will be much less certain than interpretations of the final form. Okay? So while he does not rule out conventional critical theories on the composition of Pentateuch, they're of little value. That's quite a strong statement. To the study of the Pentateuch. Now, before I finish on that note, on Klein's note, I want to say that even McConville acknowledges that actually composition of a piece of literature is helpful for interpretation. It helps you to know how it was written, who it was written to, and what the setting was. It gives you context. So whilst you shouldn't let that become your key for interpretation, just that extra pixels, those extra pixels, give you a little bit more clarity. So you shouldn't see all the work of scholars along these lines in the last 200 years as a complete waste of time. You should see that it still helps. In any case, always remember from God's perspective, in one sense, the whole thing has produced better scholarship for us. Because when people don't fight us, or when people don't say these things, and you don't fight back, or you don't think back, you don't get better. Okay? So critical thinking should not be something left at the door of the church. All right. Uh, Let's move on to retributive theology. Retributive theology. What's the time, Stephen? I feel like people are just super tired. 10 minutes. Retributive theology. Deuteronomy 11:26 is a good example of how people have come out to see that Deuteronomy is about retributive theology. That is that Deuteronomy represents a form of theology that's very primitive. If I can put it very simply, it's like a theology of do as I say or I'll hit you. Right? If you don't obey, I'll kill you. So several points can be made on this, and I think I'm not going to spend too much time on any of these in one sense, because I think you've got it in the contents of the lecture. So I'll give you a brief outline on each point. Firstly, the relationship that we see here is far more complex than represented by a simple formula. The parties involved are unique. God is not only creator, but he's also covenant Lord of his people. He's the savior who saved them, and he is their God. They are his people. You will remember that Moses' emphasis in Deuteronomy is not only on their life being in God, but also, in fact, the history of the creation, the depths of that relationship, from Egypt all the way to Moab. They are God's work. And the relationship also, in fact, is more complex because it extends back beyond their time to the patriarchs and his promises to them. So it's quite a complex relationship. You can't just say, oh, it's as simple as when you do nice things to this God, he sayangs you and gives you lots of good things. Point two, when we move further back, we see that this relationship is tied back to the salvation plan of God. So there's a larger purposes at work here. The salvation plan of God after the fall, so that the uniqueness of this setting is that they are not just any people. They're not just like the average human being in one sense. They're representative of all humanity. They are the people who will experience what it's like to come into direct contact with God. And you remember all those verses on like which nation or which people has ever come into contact with God in this way and lived. Well, they're special. They know that. Right? It's a unique relationship with unique obligations. They have him in their midst and they have to live according to his word. Right? If God was in the midst of the Canaanite tribes, same thing would have to happen. Right? So in that sense, it's no different from the garden itself. If you object to this formula here, or in this relationship you see here, then you have to object to Genesis as well. Because even in Genesis, even in that paradise where everything was so innocent and Adam was his favorite creature of God, well, you still have obligations. You still have very clear, do not eat from this tree, the fruit from this tree. To have a meaningful framework of life under God involves obligations. And when you deny those obligations, you suffer a loss of life because God is your life. Thirdly, within the context of Deuteronomy, the laws, I hope you're familiar with this, are never presented as being merely rules, rules that are to be kept. Although they sound like that, you have to keep working against that instinct, don't you? Because as you read it, you've understood it. They come in the framework of a specific relationship. They bear the character of an ethical life, as we said, under God. They are called, in fact, righteousness in 6:25. And they not only require heart obedience, they also form godly character in you. Rules don't do that for you, you know, generally speaking. But these are special. They form godly character. They actually discipline. They teach. They're the content of sanctification. Fourthly, the covenant community of God is a special possession in a specific place and time, and with that comes a physical shape, a particular physical shape of consequences, a particular physical shape of blessings, a particular physical shape of suffering. Point five, in fact, if you note, point five, in fact, if you notice carefully, people don't get what they deserve. Quite often, God's people don't get what they deserve, despite this verse and other verses like it. They are forgiven time and time again. If it was true that this verse was in kind of like a mechanistic, functional, operative mode from the day they became relational with God, well, they just die immediately. But God tolerates them very much, puts up with them. And their eventual restoration is rooted in God's own plans for salvation and humanity. So, retributive theology, too simplistic. Now, I'll skip Exodus and Deuteronomy and move on to war, because I think you'll have problems with that with some people. War, of course, as Gary was saying to me last night during dinner, it's a bit hard stomaching the fact that babies get killed.
I'll deal with that first, because that's probably the hardest for all of us. That statement itself captures our problem with war, or so-called holy war in Deuteronomy. Babies and women. But I want to make... This is being recorded. I've got to make sure I do it right, but it's going to be very difficult. I want to make the point this way. You've got to see babies, women, old men, young people, everybody as human beings. And human beings are sinful and deserving of... They deserve to be dealt as sinful human beings. They deserve to be dealt with as sinful human beings. That is one of the reasons why we have problems, is because we think babies are innocent. So we feel that in the cleansing of the land, babies shouldn't die. But a young baby and an old man are no different in that sense. My children at home are as naughty and rebellious as they will be at 35 or 55. At 35, in fact, it gets worse, because they can make their grandmother do anything they want because they're so cute. Right? But at 55, you'll have to put makeup on to get it done. Same thing, actually. Okay, the intentions are still there. My second daughter is very cute, and she says things like, "I accidentally, purposely took the cookie out of the jar." It's like, yeah, you're not very sophisticated and you're lying, but never mind. Put it back. So that I'll start with that, so that we kind of clarify any kind of like soft, warm feelings necessary that don't quite deal with the realities of God's holiness and our sinfulness. But when you look, in fact, at the verses involving the holy war, I don't really want to call it that, but in any case, the dealing with destruction of the inhabitants of the land, we see that it's not racism. So one of the big issues for people is that it's racism, because it's Jews versus the rest of the world, or Jews versus Canaanites. But you saw from 726, as we covered in the lecture, 726, well, when Jews keep detestable things in the house, they get destroyed too. So God's not pro-Jew, anti-Chinese. God's pro-God. You see? So your big problem in this whole topic is not... your big problem is not who God favors. Your big problem is God. You don't want God to say who dies, who doesn't. Well, then you have a big problem, because the Creator himself determined that you would live now, that you exist, that the sperm and the ovum would come together so that you would form you, and that you will die at a certain point in life. You have a major problem, you understand. You have a problem that God is life, and that he gives life, and he takes away life. So when you're applying this to ministry context, you never shy away from the fact that brutal truths like this come up in the Bible. Because when you don't do that, I'll show you a ministry context where it will all go pear-shaped, where it will show that you haven't really taught the church to think theologically properly. Funerals. Funerals represent that God has taken away life. And sometimes when Christians are nominal and they never understood these things, they just think, this is unfair. Well, what do you mean it's unfair? You mean that the Canaanites being destroyed was fair? What are you saying? You think that Jesus, who died on the cross for sins that were not his, is fair? Well, under God, what is fair is that God gets what he deserves, which is true worship. And these Canaanites are wicked. Do not forget the fact that within Deuteronomy itself, it teaches us that, for instance, in chapter 2, God actually provides for the non-Jewish tribes. He actually sends rain upon them, as he does for us as well. He takes care of them. He apportions land to them. He even instructs his Jewish army, his holy army, don't attack them. Don't attack them. In fact, in chapter 4, in that slightly tricky passage we talked about, in chapter 19, verse 10, and also chapter 4, in that tricky passage we were trying to work out how to fit in, the cities of refuge, what did that teach us? Well, that taught us that God values life. So far from a bloodthirsty God, we have a God who actually doesn't want life to be shed with no reason. So I think you can take it from Deuteronomy that God does not delight in babies getting killed, as if he's got a bloodlust. But God does not delight either in sin. So let me make some summary points, therefore. Firstly, in thinking through this topic, God is God, as in God is God and you are not. God is God. Secondly, man deserves destruction, including Christians. It's only because of God's gracious plan of salvation that we even have continued existence. Thirdly, God is not bloodthirsty, much prefers to bless, as you can see in Deuteronomy, and prosper people in his good creation. It's a slur and a blasphemous idea to think that the God of creation in Genesis 1, who created things and said, this is good, this is good, this is good, also likes it when he smashes things and goes, that's good too. That's good too. That's not the God that we worship. Jesus says he's the God of the living. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They're not dead. They're with him. So this God prefers life, most certainly. Fourthly, God is holy and wickedness has to meet a sure and certain result. Fifthly, God refrains, in fact, from punishing wickedness, as in when Moses begged for covenant renewal and he relented because of his character of mercy and his salvation plan. You can't see the destruction of Canaanite tribes as a once and for all statement about how God is always going to do that. You have to look at the mercy bits as well, and you have to look at his great plan. Six, in fact, we are only exempt in Jesus. If it were not for Jesus, we'd be cursed. And seven, this injustice of Jesus being cursed when we should be cursed is because Jesus does what we can't do. So a tip for you with regards to all these difficult topics is, don't be afraid of them, as I said from the start, and always end with the gospel. All right? If you shut down the young man or your friend saying, I got a difficult question for you, then you'll lose a chance to tell them the gospel at the end. So invite the customer complaints, as I said, and then work out, give them the real product, the solution. Now, the nations before the women, I think a lot of you are more interested on the women, but the nations bit, some people have argued that Deuteronomy shows no concern for the nations and the knowledge of God. Very briefly, the problem here has to do with our understanding of the character of good news. We often think that the gospel as good news cannot have bad news. But when we look at the way that the Israelites are to demonstrate that gospel or that life under God, which is good, you see that there's both a positive side and a negative side to it. So on a positive side, we've seen that Israel, in having God's words, are already unique. The way they've defeated the tribes of the land are unique. Their God is powerful. And the way they've been prospered and protected by God, well, that's saying a lot of good things about God too. But at the same time, by the time you get to chapter 29, 25 to 28, chapter 29 verses 25 to 28, you see that when the nations witness how they've been destroyed by their God because of their apostasy in the time of exile, then Moses says that the people will say, verse 25, it is because they abandoned the covenant of the Lord, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt, and went and served other gods and worshipped them. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the land, and the Lord uprooted them. So when the son of the Canaanite pagan says, hey, how come those guys who are living as our neighbors aren't there anymore? The answer is because they failed to worship God, they failed to take him seriously, they failed to be loyal to him. Now, that's part of the gospel as well. That's saying the good God who provides, it's also the good God you must take seriously with regards to his holiness and obedience to him. So our problem is that we only want to see the good news without seeing the kind of the bad news of our sin that makes the good news really brilliant. Right? And also with regards to this topic, this issue, we see in fact that by the time of Solomon, you do see at a greater level how much Israel displays that wisdom that comes from life under God. That's another topic, but you need to include that in your thinking. Women. Is that okay, Stephen? Can I keep going? Women. You've read passages in Deuteronomy, which has probably caused you to think Deuteronomy is really chauvinistic, probably, or really strange. Because I'm short of time, but actually, Deuteronomy is positive about women in a way that's unheard of in the ancient Near East. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Quick one, 20 verse 7. Has anyone been pledged to a woman and not married her? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else marry her. Now, if you're an extreme feminist, you still won't see a positive thing on this, okay? What you'll say is, it's for the guy, Guys only want sex. Sure lah, it's actually pro-man. Now, that's a problem there, because there's a certain working of the language here, which the Holy Spirit is happy to work with, in a patriarchal society. Now, if I say patriarchal, you're going to say, Christianity is patriarchal. But you see, patriarchal is not necessarily bad. When you get to Ephesians 5 anyway, nothing's changed in the New Testament. Jesus is happy for Paul to preach about how men are still the leaders in families and women need to submit to them. You see? So if you have a problem there, I can't solve that for you, okay? Right now, if you have a problem like that, at that level, can't solve it, please talk to someone, work it out, because it's going to affect your godliness eventually. But if you read verse 22 with a balanced, fair Christian mind, I think with the Holy Spirit, you will see that 22:22 is pro-marriage, pro-life, not pro-war. And I think as a woman, you've got to think that's a good thing, right? Women, how many of you, if Indonesia had national conscription, and we were fighting if, say, Indonesia, and chances your new soon-to-be husband would die in war, how many of you would prefer to have him back home than fight? Wow, you're a cold bunch of women, man. You don't want us home? Gee, that's a worry. I'm glad the Bible says it this way. No, look, Deuteronomy 22:22, it's positive, okay? Sorry, not 22:22, that's negative. 27. Yeah, go home, be with your wife. Let's start with that. Now, with regards to rules on rape, for instance, women are actually better treated in the Deuteronomy here than standards of the day. In fact, and I'll get to that, but in fact, women are actually treated as largely equal, although their roles are different. It's a reflection of not only their society, but I think the way that God created men and women, and also the way God understands the roles of men and women. So let me go to 22:22, for instance, to show you that equality. 22:22, that's how equal men and women are in the eyes of God. If a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. I think that's pretty fair. that's fair, right? You're both sinful, you both die. So there's no like, for men now we torture more, or for women, oh, you're a whore, you're going to torture you more. Nothing like that, okay? And if you don't believe how refreshing this is in one sense, go and read the laws on women of another particular religion, okay? That you know about. Women are actually spared in battle, which is actually, I don't think, very fair. But anyway, women are spared in battle, chapter 20, verse 13 to 15, all right? You go in, you want to purge a city of the men who belong to the wicked pagan tribe, or pagan nation. When the Lord delivers it into your hand, the women, children, livestock, everything else, you may take as plunder. All right? So they're spared. Now, again, if you're a feminist, or you hate God, or you're reading this in a different way, what will you say in verse 14? It's just about economic activity, getting the national GDP up, just taking things as plunder law. Now, don't tell me you weren't thinking that. But you see, if you're a woman there and your husband has just been killed in war because he was trying to kill another Israelite soldier, and in fairness, okay, the Israelite soldier, Holy Spirit's on his side, deflected the blow, killed him, fair lah, they were both trying to kill each other, okay? So your husband wasn't a hero, neither was the Israelite soldier in that sense. Israelite soldier exists by grace, your husband was trying to protect his land. Now, no heroes there, but you're left. What's the worst thing that can happen to you? You can get killed, you can get raped, you can get sold. Here, God is saying, look, you can adopt them into your family. But you see, 21 verse 10, you can't just walk into Israel and do whatever you want. Israel's a holy nation. So the fact that back in chapter 20, God was even willing to allow you into the family of Israel is pretty amazing. Because if you remember, with the nations inside Canaan, inside the land that they were apportioned, what do you have to do with everyone? Wipe out, just completely. Everybody. I don't care. As long as they're living, just wipe them out. Material things, just burn them up. But when it comes to further conquest, okay, let's say there's a land dispute and the two kings can't agree, or something goes wrong, or they encroach on your territory and you go and attack them. God's actually saying, even though they're not actually Jews, take them in. So you see, God's not like some racist God who's only out for Jewish interests, But you see that in 21 verse 10, you see that a change has to be made. And she's got to prepare herself to be part of the nation. She's got to be holy, she's got to shave her head, she's got long nails because she's part of some kind of temple worship thing, she's got to change it, she's got to change her clothes. And after she's, and there's actually a time for mourning for her mother and father, which is very respectful, then she can be your wife. Now again, if you read this as a feminist and an anti-God person, how would you read certain key verses? Well, verse 11. Sexual lust from the man, if you notice a beautiful woman. Oh, look, I can't help you there if you read it that way. Right? What's wrong with a man being attracted to a woman? And then verse 14. If you are not pleased, if unfair. But you see, verse 14, she can go wherever she wishes. You can't use her as property. Now, I can tell you that's a lot better than China was in my great-grandfather's time. I can tell you that's a lot better than many ancient cultures. It's a feudal society, you see, where lives are treated differently. And once I defeat your husband or your king, I own you. Look at this culture. They display wisdom that is different from the rest of the world. In their time, I think, this was cutting edge. It was beyond cutting edge. And that, of course, makes you think, as a church, how do we display that wisdom? Well, that's a good thing you've got to keep thinking about. 22 verse 14 to 18, and within internal relationships in Israel, 22 verse 14 to 18, look at this, right? A dude marries a girl, he slanders her, saying, I married this woman, but she's not a virgin. Now, some of you are thinking, what's wrong with that? Well, that's a problem, okay? Alright? It's different if you become a Christian and you weren't a virgin before that, but you've got to think virginity is something that God actually treasures. So 22, 14 to 18, this guy slanders her, and the parents know she is a virgin, she's been a good girl. What's going to happen is, verse 18. That's fair, right? The dude's a liar, is an idiot. She shouldn't marry him in the first place. Kenala. And that's pretty advanced, okay? And also, verse 15 to 17 of chapter 21, 15, 17 to 21. And this is a big issue in Chinese families. If a man has two wives, right, and he loves one but not the other, both have sons, but firstborn is the son of the wife he doesn't love, well, in Chinese families, chaos, man. Court battles for the rest of your life. I know this personally. But you see, he must acknowledge, verse 17, the son of his unloved wife as the firstborn. So you see, when a woman's son has the same rights, she's protected. That's how it works in ancient cultures. And you look at this, you think, man, this is advanced. God's taking care so that even the idiocy of men who want to have two wives, and by the way, Deuteronomy is not saying it's good to have two wives or it's okay. It's just saying, if you and idiot want to have, you can add an idiot bit for yourself. If you and idiot want to have two wives and have all these problems, be fair. Okay? Women are to be women. So 22 verse 5, I thought I'd add this in our cross-dressing age. 22 verse 5, a woman must not wear men's clothing, okay, girls, nor a man wear women's clothing, because the Lord detests anyone who does this, okay? God doesn't like that. No, no. And also, so basically, okay, I know like you're wearing jeans now. A lot of you have fought the women's lip thing to wear jeans. It took a long time for that to happen. But what, in one sense, our application of our time, I think, in 22 verse 5 is that men need to be men and women need to be women. You can't keep changing your sex and you can't cross-dress. Whatever that means in your time. Oh, well, it's very complex now because we lost the gospel ages ago. So keep remembering in the end to always compare Deuteronomy 24 to Mark 10. That's a very, very helpful paradigm for you. Deuteronomy 24 is one of those key passages when you read it, you think immediately, oh, Moses is saying divorce is okay. You get to Mark 10, and then you correct yourself, and you go back to Deuteronomy 24, you think about its relationship to do not commit adultery in the Ten Commandments. You remember what I taught you about how 24 and 12 to 26, chapter 12 to 26 help you understand the Ten Commandments and the way of life under God. And then hopefully it'll enlarge your vision of the law. It'll enlarge your vision to the point where, almost to the point where Jesus understood it. All right? That's my overall guide for you. I hope that helps you. When you read the text, you find difficulties, don't be frightened. But don't be blinkered as well. Interact with it and keep working through it. And the Holy Spirit will teach you. All right.